さあみんないいか、
手加減はしねえ、
無限の彼方へ。
死にてえやつだ、かかってこい、この野郎。フフフフフフフフフフフフ。
Welcome to Deep in Japan. I'm your host, Jeff Kruger, and today we are blessed with an icon in the expat community here in Japan, Jake Adelstein. For those of you who are not familiar with Jake, and I'm sure that probably 99.9% of you are, but I'll just go ahead and say it anyway, he's an American journalist, a crime writer, a blogger who spent most of his career in Japan, and he is the author of a number of books, for example, Tokyo Vice, an American reporter on the police beat in Japan, and Pay the Devil in Bitcoin, the creation of a cryptocurrency and how $500 million of it vanished from Japan. His first book, Tokyo Vice, was recently turned into an HBO television series by the same name. And as DIJ co-host Trevor has stated, and I concur, it's an absolute banger of a show. Congratulations on that, Jake, and welcome to Deep in Japan.
It's lovely to be here. You guys have been very patient as I've been hemming and hawing and dealing with the powers that be that are in charge of the TV show.
Yeah, no worries. Trevor's probably going to handle most of the HBO series questions, but I did want to ask one.
Yeah.
The last episode of the series just finished a couple of nights ago. And after seeing it all come together and finally be finished, how do you feel about it?
I feel like if I was watching this show, that I would hate HBO and me, because there's so many cliffhangers. You know, people must be wondering, what is there going to be a second season? Is this how it ends? And the answer is, I have no idea. You know, we've all have our favorite series that ended in the middle. For me, this, you know, I'm staking out some geek territory here. I loved Millennium. You know, it's Chris Carter's minor film with Lance Hendrickson. TV series, kind of a FBI profiler Armageddon story. You know, the third season ended, they never really kind of resolved it, and years later I'm still hoping that Chris Carter makes a conclusion to it. So I would be it's a great series. If that's how it ends, I think people will be eternally disappointed. You can always read the book, I guess.
Oh no, my boomer dad is calling. Can you guys hear that?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yes, I can.
Good timing, huh?
A little bit. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
I am trying to mute him, but you can't mute a boomer, as you both know.
I didn't know that. I'm 53. What does that make me? Am I a boomer? Am I Generation X?
Oh my God, he's calling again. Do you guys mind if I just tell him that I'm not available? I just need to tell him that I'm not available. He will not stop. He's relentless. He's a Vietnam vet.
Please do.
I am so sorry. Just give me one sec.
Oh, man, it's almost like he knew we were just sitting down.
Hey, Dad, I'm actually in the middle of a recording. Can I call you back in a couple hours? Can't hear you. I got headphones on my ears. Can I call you back, Dad? I'm in a recording. I hope you're feeling well, okay? I got to let you go. I'll call you back, all right? Love you, Dad. I'm not sure if he understood me. He's got coronavirus right now.
Oh, no.
And, Yeah. But he's like 150 or whatever it is. Jesus Christ, he's calling me back. Can you hear that? Can you not hear that?
Yeah.
Guys, I'm so sorry. Take two. Talk amongst yourself so I mute myself.
We'll take two.
Yeah.
You know, actually, I've written three books, but the other two were published in France. And France is where I sell the most books. I'm like the Jerry Lewis of true crime.
Really? I didn't know that. Yeah. That's really interesting. Are they published in French?
They're published in French. I have a very good translator, Cyril Gay. He's kind of like my French doppelganger. He talks like I do. His English is very good. He translated Tokyo Vice in 2016. It became a bestseller in France that launched their small publishing house. Then they published The Last Yakuza. And then they published I Sold My Soul for Bitcoins. That's the sort of the translation of the French title. So I've done two books with them, and the fourth book will also be with these publishers because they're very easy to work with. And I can walk the streets of France and people come up to me and recognize me. It's really, really strange, but nice.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and I'm back, guys, sorry. And the artwork is absolutely gorgeous. It's like worlds better than anything I've seen out there. It's amazing.
It's all done by Guillaume, who is trained in the art of making woodblock prints. So they're all woodblock prints that he's painstakingly made. So every single cover is a woodblock print. The cover for I Sold My Soul for Bitcoins has a ton of like kanji puns that I don't think most people get. Including the symbol for pi, because Mark Karpolis loved pi so much. There's a reference to his love of women in cat uniforms that's kind of obscene, so we're not going to discuss it here, but all of those things are all buried in the cover. So it's a very playful cover, one of my favorites. And the nicest thing about French readers is they really read your books like all the way. And when I Sold My Soul for Bitcoins came out in like 2019, and I went to France and was doing book signings and stuff, and people would come up to me and they would say, it's so nice to see that you have no mention of the Yakuza in your book here. You've really grown as an author. We're so proud of you. And I was like, well, thank you. I'm very happy not to be writing about the Yakuza in a book as well. It's a nice change of pace. So there you go. France, loved in France, like Jerry Lewis.
Well, you're pretty big in Japan, too. I would think that, you know, when I reached out to all my friends and listeners and fellow journalists and, you know, everybody knows who you are and they all have questions for you, which today I've actually incorporated some of those questions into the interview.
Yeah, they're good questions. The sad thing is that I can't get Tokyo Vice published in Japanese, not in print, for the life of me. It was published on Amazon, and Audible made an incredibly elaborate audiobook version, including using like three or four different actors, which I don't think many people know, but you know, to find a publisher who will handle that book, you know, I don't know if that'll ever happen.
Why do you think that is? It's you know, France loves it. France picked it up. English, obviously, it's booming. HBO picked it up. What is it about the Japanese, you know, publishing market that makes it difficult for this book to get into print?
Well, I would say that they're chicken shits. I mean, you know, I can't put it in a better way. The first publisher of the book, and I'm not going to name them because at the time that was a reasonable fear. They hired someone to do a consultation on the book, and you know, the reviewer who knew a lot about organized crime and the underworld and said, you know, it's, you know, basically it's a great book, but if you're going to publish it, you should have some experience dealing with the Yakuza. The Gotogumi is particularly violent and not forgiving of people that cross them. So they might resort to violent means such as kidnapping your employees. And therefore, you should, you know, handle this book with extreme caution and beef up your corporate security. And because they dropped it. And then recently I had another company that showed interest, and then the final analysis was like, well, Goto Tadamasu is still alive. Yes, we know that he was connected to Soka Gakkai, but you're too explicit about it. And what were the other things? Oh, and there's a passage about Itami Juzo probably being killed. And they're like, all of these things make this book really, really too much of a taboo for us, and we're going to pass. And I was like, okay, I guess that's probably going to be the case for everything. I mean, there's probably other things in the book that I don't even realize are a taboo that I'm stepping on. But, you know, if people want to read it online, they can't. So it's better than not having it available at all.
Well, I love the book. I think I've passed through it twice now. It's infinitely readable. The way you write is you're a very polished writer. It's very smooth, very easy to pick up, engaging. So, you know, from the book's perspective, I would just say it's a AAA book, and I'm absolutely flabbergasted that it hasn't been picked up in Japan. I mean, that's just blows my mind.
It's very nice of you to say that it's well written. As a matter of fact, when I started writing it, I hadn't written in English for so many years that the only way I could think of writing it was to imagine I was talking to an old friend that I'd been out of touch. So it's sort of written like I was talking to one person. And that's still basically my writing style. I'm not very literary, but you know, I'm a newspaper reporter. We're not literary. You know, it's certainly in a Japanese newspaper that wasn't demanded of you.
Yeah, that makes sense. Trevor's going to go ahead and talk a little bit about the HBO series now. I'm more of the book guy, okay. And obviously the questions from the listeners. But yeah, Trevor, why don't you go ahead and jump right in? I know that you just had a fresh viewing of it. So tell us, how did you like it? And what are your questions for Jake?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. First of all, thank you so much for joining us, allowing me to join as well. I'm extremely excited. I spent some time as a very, very small filmmaker, but I spent a lot of time researching the art of film. And so getting to speak with somebody who's actually gone through this process of having their story turned into an HBO series is just extremely exciting for me. And the show is absolutely amazing. And so a ton of questions. Anything that you don't feel comfortable answering, I know that working with such a large company as HBO, can be tricky. There's lots of landmines. And so feel free to pass on any of these questions that I might ask you. But, first of all, in going through this process, obviously having the book turned into a script for this series, were there any clashes at all? Was there any disagreement? How much input did you get to have in that process as it was being written? Or were you fairly hands-off once it had been kind of put into HBO's hands?
Well, at the very beginning, J.T. Rogers and I went to high school together, so we're good friends. And I dragged him into this project like 10 years ago. He's worked many years for no pay. This has gone through many different variations and possibilities. But when the TV series got pretty much greenlit, I went to his home, in sort of the suburbs of New York. And we spent about 3 days sort of hammering out what would be the basic plot line. He wanted this side story about, an up-and-coming Yakuza who's sort of the parallel to... I can't talk about myself in the third person. So let's say the other Jake, Taj. Mm-hmm. That's how I refer to him, Taj, the other Jake. And I was not very enthusiastic about it. I do have a classmate who ended up joining the Yakuza, which is a crazy story. And he's been in and out of it a couple times. So there's a grain of truth there. But other than that, that I was like, okay, if we're going to have this side story about Yakuza, I want the boss of Jake to be an amalgamation of all the great female reporters that I've worked with over the years, because, this is very male heavy, and there's, women working in the National News Department are far and few between, and in a way they have it harder than even a foreigner does, and I think we should pay respect to that. He was like, okay, we'll make Jake's boss Emmy. An amount, a sort of representative of the good female reporters you worked with, and show some of the problems that a female reporter has working on the police beat and in that society. And so that was a nice compromise. One of the reasons we didn't have a lot of conflicts is in the writer's room. Probably, here's a bit of trivia for your people. Two of the most highly rated shows on TV right now are Pachinko and Tokyo Vice has very good reviews. Both of them have great reviews. And the common link between them is Mari Yamamoto. So Mari Yamamoto is a journalist, actor, who was in the writer's room for almost all of season one, and who I've worked with at Daily Beast for like 6-7 years now. She's also has a important role in Pachinko, the TV series. And, I think, so she's connected to both of these, which is kind of interesting. But because I had Mari, because Mari was in the writer's room doing interpreting and translation and weighing in on various topics, there was at least there was sort of like one person in the room who really understood Japan and understood better than everyone else the police beat and the things at that time, because she prepared, she studied. So there wasn't a lot of conflict. There were moments, when I would sort of be whispered in my ear, I get an email asking me about something that I just banged my head on the table and was like, no, absolutely not. That was the storyline about a Russian, what if the Yakuza had a conflict with the Russian mafia moving in? I'm like, no, that never happened. It's not even close to reality. Like, please drop that immediately and slap the writer that came up with that across the face and tell him to read the goddamn materials that he's been given. That was it. That was like the moment I was just like, let's not jump the shark. And to his credit, JT quickly shot that down.
Well, yeah, it's great to hear that you actually got quite a bit of input there. And I mean, was there anything that you wish they would have included? It sounds like you got to shoot down, you know, a couple of very questionable ideas.
No, I thought that they did that. It's very true to the spirit of the book. There is a huge emphasis on the mechanics of journalism. Like, journalism isn't like a side note. You see people doing the work, collecting the data. I mean, you know, it is an important part of the storyline, the importance of journalism, doing journalism right. And I was very pleased with that. My job essentially was to go over all the scripts and flag things that couldn't happen or that were not possible, or if there was a storyline that just, you know, you couldn't have in 1999, to say, no, you know, this is too early. We don't have a smartphone, so that's not going to happen. You know, the Japanese police didn't have permission to use wiretapping until very late in, you know, 1999, and they didn't really do the first wiretap until like 2000. So that's not likely to happen. I mean, there are things that are, a little off, but mostly it's very accurate. The attention to detail and the sets. I don't think that people realize this. You guys might realize this. Even the Yakuza fanzines are constructed like their own original Yakuza fanzine with covers and pages and articles. And they made parodies of like Shukan Bunshun and Aira and, female magazines and stuff like Hanako and stuff. It's like all that stuff is in the background. There's this incredible attention to detail, things that no one will ever see. So all of that, I was extremely pleased at how well they did it.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that initially really drew me into the story was how accurately I felt it was portrayed. And unlike both of you and Jeff, this was around the time you were first arriving in Japan. Is that right? I think it was. Personally, I didn't get there until 15 years later. So I didn't kind of know this period of time in Japan. But it had a certain ineffable quality to it that really kind of hooked me right from the beginning.
Are you talking about when Jake got to Japan? What year did you arrive in Japan, Jake? Oh, me? Yeah. Everybody knows when I came to Japan. Let's ask Jake.
I arrived in Japan in 1988.
Well, no, I'm just trying to compare because this was... Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead, Jake.
I arrived in 1988. And I started on the job in 1993.
Wow, so early.
I officially started the job in 1993. In 1992, I did like a short mini internship with the OMD to see if I could hack it for myself. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see like what is this job going to be like. And it said in 1999. In 1999, I had just been in Saitama for years, and I was pulled up from the Saitama bureau to the National News Department and put on the 4th District, which is Kabukicho and Waseda and Totsuka, Keisatsu, that area.
So I guess actually, yeah, when you got moved there, I was a student at Waseda. That's actually when I came over, was 2000. So about a year after you moved. So there's time-wise anyway, you were out at night and I was studying during the day.
I went drinking with some of my colleagues from the fourth district. You know, now they're like, you know, like the president, you know, the head of the National News Department, or become very, you know, important people. And we were talking about, you know, the time that we decided to call a truce. All at least four of us, and instead of trying to scoop each other, we just go out bowling every night and drink. It was some kind of nice, pleasant period of peacefulness, right? You know, we're still doing our job, but we're also like, you know, okay. Like, we turned in our articles, like, are we going to go bowling? Are we going to go to karaoke? Are we going to go, you know, going to eat yakiniku? What will it be? Are we going to play baseball? You know, those are the good times.
Yeah. I feel like the sense of camaraderie, really came through, especially, you know, in the early couple episodes, you know, the early years, or the early time that you spent at the newspaper. It sounds like that was pretty accurately portrayed, would you say?
It is. I'm still in touch with Tsuji Naoki-san, who quit the first year. I think in the book I call him Frenchie. And he spoke to the writers, which was wonderful. About his time at the Yomiuri, and he later went on and worked at a couple other media outlets, and is now teaching writing at Kyoto University. He's written like two or three really good novels. You know, not the kind of stuff that I would normally read because it's very, very literary, but he's a good writer. Yeah, the camaraderie is definitely there. I watched that and I was like, yeah, that was, you know, that was a really good time. I miss some of my colleagues at the Omiri, but I wrote this editorial in 2011 in defense of my old boss, in which I called the president of the Omiri a cancer on the face of journalism. And that sort of resulted in me getting the equivalent of, in the Yakuza world, what they call that Zen Shobun, like not only banned, but, you know, like kill on sight order. So, you know, my buddies were like, you know, Adelstein, that you went a little too far there. Like, we can't even be seen with you. You're like, you know, you're like a death warrant. And I'm like, okay, I'm sorry. I'll just keep my distance. So
maybe that's why your book's not getting published, is that blacklisting from Yomiuri.
Well, you know, I don't have negative things to say about the Yomiuri. I wish that they, you know, didn't hold that one editorial against me. My boss, Kiyotake-san, is a great journalist. He's written two or three books, which ironically are also on Wow Wow. The actor who plays Miyamoto, and I'm sorry, I cannot remember the actor's name. Can you guys remember the name?
We can look it up.
Ito Hidoaki? Is it Ito Hidoaki?
I have no idea, and I have to actually go tie up my dog. So, Trevor, keep moving through those questions about HBO's documentary series, Tokyo Vice, I will be right back. Give me 2 minutes, boys. There's
you're
so
struggling
many
today,
today,
Jeff. Come on. Get it together.
Oh, my God. I'll keep going. I'll be right. Give me 2 minutes.
All right.
Okay.
Well, for me, when I went on set one day and I met the actor playing Miyamoto, he was like, oh, hey, I know your boss, Kiyotake-san. And, you know, he referred to him as like, you know, my teacher, my sensei. Mm-hmm. That's kind of interesting to have that connection to, you know, your boss in this drama and this one actor sort of, you know, who also plays a cop in the TV series that Kiyotake-san wrote for the Wow Wow series that was based on his book, Throwing Stones. To be in this drama. So I feel kind of strangely connected. It's a small world, right?
Yeah, for sure. It looks like it's Hideaki Ito played Miyamoto.
Yeah. He's a great actor. And the thing that we have in common is that he's also been dramas written by my boss at the Omiri Shimbun, the one that I really liked, who quit the Omiri in a blaze of glory and then was sued into oblivion, and the one who I wrote in editorial in defense of. So there you are.
Well, let me ask you, obviously they had to cast somebody to play you. And I can't imagine that is an easy process, you know, to have somebody come in and kind of portray not only, you know, you, but your story. How did you think that Ansel Elgort did in that portrayal? And did you have any input there? In terms of casting, or there again, was that more HBO bringing in somebody?
I had very little input. I don't think I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. They had maybe two actors that they were considering, and Ansel really wanted to do it, and he seemed really enthusiastic, like super enthusiastic. And I said, you know, well, enthusiasm counts for a lot. So maybe if he doesn't, exactly, you know, look the part, but if he's really into doing it and he's this, you know, and he's actively, you know, pursuing the role, then why don't you give it to him? Because in the end, enthusiasm counts for a lot more than you know, you'd rather have someone who's enthusiastic and really into it, who's going to study Japanese, than someone who you might mm-hmm. think is a better fit, but, you know, it's kind of like, well, you know, it's just another role for me. And to his credit, he studied Japanese like crazy. He shadowed journalists. He peppered me with questions. He did things like he studied Aikido with great fervor.
Oh, wow.
And he did things like, you know, like hand me a pack of cigarettes. And, you know, I stopped smoking clove cigarettes like in 2011, as a present. But I think obviously to watch to see how I smoked. So I see some of my mannerisms aped there, especially my sisters say so. And I'm like, well, you know. The only thing I said to him is, you know, it's a character, it's not me. So you do whatever you want with it. You know, you do what you feel is authentic. I think he did a great job. His Japanese is amazing.
So a couple things there. One, I think the choosing someone based on their enthusiasm is a great choice, and especially at this point in your life, you know, young and with this new job. I mean, the portrayal of you as being young and enthusiastic and really, you know, going out and making something happen there. I think that came through loud and clear. And I have to imagine that enthusiasm that he showed for the role played into his ability to act, you know, just very kind of enthusiastic, the way he portrayed you. Would you say that was a fair portrayal? Were you, you know, very enthusiastic at the time?
I was extremely enthusiastic,
yeah. I would imagine.
It's a TV series, you know, in real life, sure. my discovery of that investigative journalism is important. And, you know, and when I began sort of butting heads with the powers that be, didn't really come until 5 or 6, maybe 4 or 5 years into the job. Did I, you know, have the confidence to say like, no, this story should go in. This is important. Run this story. Mm-hmm. You know, first I was just trying to survive.
Right. Yeah. I was going to say in the portrayal in the show, and obviously timelines get condensed, you know, and for good reason, because the ultimate goal is to tell a engaging story, you know, right. in a fairly short amount of time. So, you know, that being said, very quickly on, you know, Ansel is being portrayed, or Jake is being portrayed. I don't. Yeah, it's very strange.
The other Jake, Taj.
Taj. Yeah. That's right. Okay. So Taj is being portrayed as kind of almost immediately coming into conflict with his, you know, his coworkers, and boss, in terms of pushing forward stories or writing styles that were not, you know, accepted. And obviously the newspaper was very, we just want the facts, you know, and we don't need the editorial added on. But it sounds like that didn't actually happen until years later. Would you say that early on you were pretty by the book in terms of the way you were going about it?
Yeah, I was by the book. I did get that. Don't put too many adjectives in. Like, don't use these yoji jukugo, which are like compound Japanese, like 4 kanji in a row that sort of tell a story or mm-hmm. have a profound meaning, like a proverb. I did get that. You know, it's like, you know, this is a newspaper. We'll have fewer adjectives. Don't use, you know, these literary flourishes. though, you know, an incident that happened very early in the show, getting chewed out for writing that it was a, you know, writing that the police are investigating as a murder,
right.
rather than as a manslaughter. That actually happened to me at the Shinjuku police. There was a incident in which a Chinese gentleman was murdered at very almost point blank range. You know, I think a guy walked into a restaurant, shot the guy, left. You know, clearly to me that's murder, right? But you know, mm-hmm. I wrote it without even checking. I wrote it up as police are investigating as a murder, and that was not the case. And you know, the article came out, and you know, someone realized that we had this, and everybody else had something else. And you know, I was like, you know, how can this not be a murder? And, you know, a guy walks in, he shoots someone, and you know, the police officer talking to me was like, well, they exchanged words, so therefore it was a quarrel in which someone got hot tempered and then fired. So it's, you know, violence resulting in death. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. And then he said, off the record. He said, off the record. He said, Adelson, off the record. Like, this is a Chinese guy. We're not going to set up a murder investigation for a Chinese guy, probably killed by another Chinese guy. We're never going to solve it. Our clearance rates will drop. And it's, you know, and it's a waste of resources. And plus, we look bad. So it's manslaughter. And I was like, okay, now I understand how things work here.
Did that, during your time, you know, covering, you know, the police beat, did that change at all? Or was that pretty consistent over that time period?
You know, what has changed on the police beat is that, you know, in the early days, I'm going to do a plug for Unseen Japan here, which is kind of like the print version of you guys. I wrote 2 articles for Unseen Japan on, like, you know, everything you wanted to know about Tokyo Vice, the book, but were too busy watching the TV series to ask, and, you know, everything you want to know about Jake Adelstein, but were reasonably afraid to ask, you know, just like, because you get tired of seeing articles written by, like, is there really a Jake Adelstein? This is what we know about him. And I'm kind of like, and same with the book. But in mm-hmm. that, in those 2 articles is a link that says, like, you know, Tokyo Vice, Unseen Japan, Tokyo Vice, and it's a folder with all the material, like with a, like a hundred page, but you know, hundreds of pages of materials from the time that I was on the police beat and afterwards as well, so the people can read the articles that were in the, that I wrote for the Omiri for themselves. And also they can see what a press release, police press release looks like. And in the old days, a police press release would list the address of the victim. I mean, like down to like, you know, the room number. And, you know, as the years went by and the laws changed, especially with the personal privacy laws coming in, which are really, really designed to protect politicians, you know, that information just became vaguer and vaguer. By the time I left the police beat, we were having, you know, cases where someone would be arrested for assault and, you know, they wouldn't even put the age of the victim. You know, it would be like, you know, real estate agent in his 30s, you know, assaulted by this guy, you know, sort of an address and the assailant's name and his age. But the victim, you had no idea who the victim was. So, if you know, even if you wanted to find out more details, you were stymied because, you know, the information has gotten vaguer and vaguer. That has really changed. I don't know how people, I wouldn't be comfortable writing an article about the arrest of someone without knowing who the victim is.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, would you say that, is there any pushback from the media at all? And I have very little insight into the way the Japanese media operates. Obviously, there's, you know, like I said, there's a lot less editorializing even today from what I hear, you know, news broadcasts and such. But is there any drive within, you know, say, reporters to go out and try to change any of that or get those details? Or is it very much just, this is the system we understand,
I would say there's very little.
Okay.
You know, there are newspapers like Tokyo Shimbun, which is Chunichi Shimbun, depending upon where you are in Japan, really tries to do good investigative journalism amongst the newspapers. I mean, they really push. The Shukan Bunshun, the weekly Bunshun, and Shukan Shincho do great investigative journalism. The obstruction of the rape, the obstruction of the investigation into the rape of Shiori Ito, the journalist, that scoop was Shukan Shincho, including the names of the cop who interfered with that, who pulled the arrest warrant, who was rewarded for his complicity in covering that up by becoming the head of the National Police Agency, which tells you a lot about Japan. You're a top cop. You block a legitimate rape investigation. You tear up the arrest warrant for someone and you basically let them walk. And your reward is you become the head of the National Police Agency. That's the Japan we're living in now.
Yikes.
Jake, I want to jump ahead to questions from DIJ listeners, but you already brought up Unseen Japan, the article recently that you produced for Unseen Japan. I'm not sure if Trevor realizes that Noah was actually on the podcast. Do you remember the Wakayama Reefer Madness episode?
Oh,
that's Unseen Japan. That's Noah. That's him.
We're friends on Facebook. He's killing it right now.
Yeah, he recently did two articles with Jake, which I feel like is the answer that you're giving to the question. Which, and I'll just go ahead and read now from DIJ listeners. We've got one from Ardo Debito, who everybody knows, and his question is, "What parts
I am familiar with him.
Everybody's familiar with Debito. He only had one question for you, whereas other people, I literally had to like shave off questions. They would send me like 20 or 30, and I'd have to like cut them down and be like, okay, I'll go with these, you know. But Debito had one question for you, and it's, what parts of your book Tokyo Vice, if any, are semi-fictionalized for dramatic effect? And I feel like you've already sort of preemptively answered that question with the articles in Unseen Japan, but I'm going to put it to you anyway so that you can, you know, verbally answer this question.
Well, I mean, you know, if you read the book, there's two pages, like I think it's page 331 in the book itself, called Notes on Sources and Sources Confidentiality, in which I explain, in order to protect names, that I've changed dates and things, dates and situations and people's names, so that I don't blow my sources, because that's a really bad one as a journalist. I'm trying to think if I over dramatize anything in the book. I don't think so. But I definitely have changed dates and times, and I have changed the names of criminals. And the reason I did that is because originally this was going to be published in Japan, where, you know, there's this idea that if criminals have served their time and gone back out into the world, that you should let them rejoin society so that you don't publish their name after they're out of jail and they've served their time, which I decided was fair. So, you know, the names of the pickpocket and people who are, you know, involved in minor crimes, I've deliberately changed their name and their age so that they can't be identified because, you know, I think even a pickpocket or an ATM robber deserves a second chance at life. And some people have found fault with that. I don't think I made that clear in the sources and the confidentiality thing, which I probably should have had. But other than that, no, it's not dramatized. It's just as it is.
Cool. And, you know, again, just to plug Noah and his work on Unseen Japan, for people who want to follow up on all the documentation that Jake referenced earlier, I've actually gone into that file and I was amazed by all the documents that you produced for that, you know, from over a decade ago. It was well done.
Well, I always kept a hold of that stuff. You can't write a book from memory, right? So, you know, there's my diary entries.
Sure.
There's the articles in the Amiri. It's funny because, you know, you don't get a byline as a Yomiuri reporter, right? You don't, you know, maybe right. You're starting to now, but I'm also, I'm not egotistical, but I do like, who doesn't like their work to be recognized, right? If you bust your balls and get something done, you sort of want people to know it's you. So the only time that you would get, basically a byline or your name is if you wrote an explainer piece or an op-ed. So whenever I would have a really good scoop, I would immediately write an op-ed or an explainer. So I could sort of say like, yeah, that was mine, you know, suck it up as other reporters, because that was me. If you look through the articles I wrote for the Amiri, you see ones with the Jay Adelstein byline, because I think Jake Adelstein took like more than one line. So I think it's some place it just ended up being Jay. Then you'll know that I'm quietly saying, hey, you know, your previous article relating to this was my scoop. Thank you very much.
Well, it's a good thing that you provide all that and you kept all those documents, because I've been on websites. And by the way, you have the biggest collection of people who love your work and also of trolls that I've ever seen. And some of the websites that I've been to who seem to have dedicated their entire existence to like taking you down, like that's what they wanted. They're like, they've got you in their sights and they're obsessed with you. And one of those pages, the guy was actually claiming that you never worked for Yomiuri, and you've got like documents showing, you know, that you were, you know, you're like an employee name card and stuff like that. Like you've got all that stuff photocopied. People can see that you actually worked there.
Well, the one that I love the most is that they, you know, I think this is like, there's a pamphlet to recruit people, right? And they have this, not only have this picture of me, but they have this really sort of comic book version of me that's really fat with all the like digital devices I was carrying at the time to sort of show how I'm like, you know, like a cutting edge technology reporter. And I guess, you know, if you're a conspiracy theorist, yeah, you know, I could have forged this entire pamphlet, including this unflattering cartoon version of myself, but probably not. We report, you decide. You guys still there?
I am, Jeff. Did we lose you?
Sabe,
Oh, I was muted. Sorry, I was muted and I had a question.
Jeff,
sorry.
Didn't you just talk about the mute button? Pull it together, man.
I know.
Pull it together.
I've got the task cam, and then
You're struggling.
I think I might actually have COVID. Everybody in my family is sick. We've been coughing like crazy.
Oh,
Jake is
man.
Recovering from COVID. I don't know if I haven't been tested, but I'm not in a good place today. Anyway, yes, I muted myself, but I was going to say, Jake, if you are in the forgery business, you know, as the conspiracy theorists say, and I looked in that file and I saw the essay that you wrote for the entrance exam to Yomi Erdi, and I thought, gosh, nobody would forge that because the handwriting is atrocious. I was like, if someone's going to forge like an essay that they had written from the 90s in Japanese, it would at least have beautiful print. I'm sorry, Jake, this might sound like a backhanded compliment, but that is the worst handwriting that I think I've ever seen in Japanese, so I'm 100% sure it's legitimate.
Thank you very much. Yeah, terrible handwriting.
But yeah, we don't want to talk about your handwriting. I wanted to continue along with questions from DIJ listeners. We've kind of answered Debito's. And Debito, if you're listening to this, go check out the Unseen Japan articles by Jake and check out those primary sources and documents that he has there. The next questions, there's four of them that I have, are from David McNeil, who is an acclaimed journalist and a professor of journalism. David asks, you and I have both been targeted by trolls.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with them?
Wow. Okay. So there's about four ways to deal with them. And actually, maybe not get four. So let me say there's a number of ways to deal with them because I don't want to trap myself in saying the four. Yeah. David has been trolled much worse than I have. And I think we've written some really good articles together, at least two or three. One way that I deal with trolls is I just block them. I mean, no. Screw it. The life is too short to get in an argument with people who don't want to listen. I believe in the Tao Te Ching, it says, you know, the sage does not argue, he does not contend. And I think, you know, Lao Tzu, when he was writing that 2,000 years ago, was quite wise. Sometimes I go through my trolls and I find one of them who's the most odious. And then using my investigative journalism skills, I figure out who they are and where they work. And the most offensive, horrible thing that they posted. And then I bring it up and I comment on it. Usually it's something that's slightly pedophilia-like. And I'm like, you know, does your boss know that you are into this? Or like, you know, like, yeah, I may have my issues, but what about you, pal? Like, what are you doing? And yeah, I mean, that's really vicious, right? But but all the other trolls see that and like, Jesus Christ, this guy's, he's a mean asshole. Like, maybe he's gonna out me. Maybe he's gonna like come after me. And that scares away many of them. So. You know, they say don't feed the trolls, but sometimes you just want to stuff their face full of so much unpleasantness that they walk away, and that usually makes the other trolls walk away. I mean, it's not nice, but, you know, that's one of the new rules of journalism. When people don't like the messenger, and when they don't like the message, they attack the messenger. So you better protect yourself, because if people don't think you're credible, they're not going to trust you as a journalist. So it's an obstruction of your work. So you have to take those threats seriously. And then, you know, sometimes I make fun of them, you know, because they're so ridiculous. And now and then I've actually befriended my trolls. I'm like, because sometimes they just don't understand. They're just simply misguided.
So this isn't friends close, enemies closer. This is like enlighten them. Let's bring them in.
Yes. Yes. It rarely works, but sometimes it does. Sometimes you say like, okay. Maybe that expression there was a little bit extreme, but what about this? And sometimes you can have a dialogue. Then you take it offline and you go, look, you know, we're not enemies. We agree on some things. Can we be at least civil to each other? So that's how you do it. You either mute them, you make an example out of one, and scare away the other trolls. You make fun of them, or you befriend them.
Does befriending them, in your experience, work? Have you had any success stories, people that you're friends with even to this day, who you can look back on and go, wow, I converted a troll to a friend?
Yes. I've got about four of them.
Wow. Four of them.
I've got four of them. The problem is one of them I've become such good friends that he's like this attack dog. So when someone comes after me or like is trolling me, that he starts trolling them. And I really appreciate this. I really appreciate you're not making the situation better.
when you've got a hammer and that's all you've got, the whole world is nails, right? So it's just like you've got a troll in your pocket now. You can unleash it on other people. That's interesting.
Here's one of those yojijukugo that my boss would never let me use. It's like Ichibatsu Hyakkai Shikazu, which is one punishment is better than 100 laws. So if, you know, sometimes you're dealing with a troll, you just find one, knock them off, and it makes the other trolls run away because most of them are cowards. That doesn't always work, but it works surprisingly well. Ideally, and I say this as someone who is supposed to be a little more enlightened, ideally you would like to clear up the misunderstanding and come to some agreement with each other where you can have civil discourse. If that's possible, that's the best solution.
Sure. I remember, I want to say it's like a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, that the Deep in Japan community on Facebook, the group, had a right-wing Japanese guy in the group. I'm not going to say his name, but he was partial to like black Yakuza-style sunglasses and had a shaved head. So you probably know who I'm talking about, Jake, because when he was in the group, I remember you telling me, I know that guy, he's trouble. And I was using the tactic that you mentioned, like befriend the troll. And I was like trying to be friends with this guy and enlighten him and see if we could get on this. It just didn't work out in the end. It just got worse. He like blew up. He left the group in a huff. And yeah, I mean, I would almost consider him dangerous at this point, but I would like to see examples of that work in my own life at some point. So far, I haven't been able to make it work befriending the trolls.
Well, I mean, it's very hard because first you have to assess what the trolls are coming from, what they believe, what are their standpoints on things. Then you have to show them how their actions don't match what they espouse. Or you have to show them, like, you know, this is what I feel and this is why I do the things that you do. Don't you think that's a good cause? And, you know, sometimes you can rationally reason to someone, you can find common ground. But like I said, like it's hard, right? Pressing the block button is so much easier. And increasingly, that's what I'm doing. Like, block, like, you know, go bother someone else.
Sure. Well, we got a lot of questions here, Jake, so I'm just going to keep moving through them. This is the second question from David McNeil again.
Okay.
There's a perception that a TV adaptation of a book brings instant riches, but I imagine the reality is not so rosy. At the risk of being vulgar and baiting the tax man, can you give us some idea of the financial arrangements for something like Tokyo Vice?
Bold question.
It is a bold question.
Yes. How much you making, Jake? Come on.
If I'm making as much as you think I'd make, I wouldn't still be writing for the Daily Beast and the Asia Times. So
I think you could just say you wouldn't be doing the Deep in Japan podcast.
That's for sure.
No, yeah. I would be doing the Deep in Japan podcast.
Jake, your $100 check is in the mail. You can, that's COD is as good as money.
I will say that. So, if you write a book that is sort of autobiographical, usually in Hollywood, you know, they buy the life rights, which means that they buy the right to depict you any way they want from a certain period of time, you know, this period to that period, and there's, you know, usually there's a good amount paid for that. And then with this TV series, you know, depending upon, you know, how smart you are with the contract, you might. You might get a fee, you might get a fee per episode, and that's usually, you know, depends that it's produced, right? You know, if it's supposed to be 10 episodes and they only make four, you only get paid for four. And other than that, I don't think I can say anything more without probably stepping on some odious NDA that I'm not even aware I have. But it's not the money that you think it is. You know, it's nice and you know, it worked out, you know, now the series has aired, I can actually sort of like send in a bill. You know, it's not enough to retire on. Sorry to all the people. If you get one book turned into a TV series, you're set for life. No, it doesn't work that way. Or maybe it works that way if you're smarter than me.
I get the impression that, you're not going to retire off one TV. Sadly, because I mean, wow, what a huge achievement. You would think that would, you know, get you in a position where you'd be pretty secure financial wise for the rest of your life, but not so. There's a lot of content being churned out and big companies like HBO, obviously they need to pump it out as cheaply as they can. They're a corporation as well. So I get it. Next question, again from David McNeil, is Reviews for the series have been very solid. Do you think there will be a follow-up? And will you play a cameo?
Ooh.
Oh, I hope that there's a follow-up because it's, you know, people are sort of left, are very much left hanging, but I don't know. I would love to play a cameo. I would love to just be someone random, you know, that the other Jake runs into on the subway who pats him on the shoulder and says, if you're going there, you're going the wrong way. That's it. That's the scene that I envisioned for myself. Just giving the misguided Jake a direction. Like, no, if you're trying to go there, you're going the wrong way. That's it. But I don't know if that'll happen.
That'd be amazing.
I've made an appeal to the showrunner. In the Hollywood world, the term the showrunner, which is a new one for me, is like, that's JT, my senpai. You know, he is, you know, in a sense more powerful than the director, you know, the person that makes the magic happen. But will he grant me my wish to have a cameo? I don't know.
You remember that the scene in the book where you get transferred to Tokyo and you go in to claim your desk, and there is a guy sitting in a chair eating a senbei and kind of blowing out all over the crumbs all out over the room or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be funny if you played that guy, like the guy that is being replaced. That would be hilarious. I don't know why. That's just the first thought that came to my mind. But having you play somebody on the street, a random, you know, passerby that gives directions, okay, it's good. But like, I feel like there's something much more amusing that could be done with that.
Well, I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, I would love to have Dan Radcliffe, who's originally going to play the other Jake, run into Ansel on the street. You know, I think that would be hilarious. And Dan's got a really good sense of humor. But you know, will that happen? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Did we get through all of McNeil's questions? No, last one.
Okay.
Last one from David McNeil. There has been online grumbling, as you know, about your use of anonymous sources. No, you already answered this question, so I think we can skip it. That was like right at the beginning of the interview. So let's keep going. Well, we'll go down to...
I'll just answer one more time.
Let me properly ask it then. So okay. There's been some grumbling online about your use of anonymous sources. Can you explain your methodology and explain this practice to listeners?
Yes. Japan has two laws about public servants, the National Public Servants Laws and the Regional Public Servants Law, and it makes it a crime for any public employee to share information that they've gained on the job. Now, they aren't always prosecuted for doing that, but they can. And if you name them in a story, and the reasons they aren't named in stories is because they would be admitting to a crime. You would be accusing them of a crime. They could be fired and they could go to jail, and some of them have been sent to jail. There are numerous examples of this happening, and that's why you have to make your government sources anonymous most of the time. Just for the hell of it, I looked up the word sosa kankeisha, which is essentially like sources close to the investigation, right? So I did a database search for six newspapers for the last week. There were 167 times that newspapers used the words according to and close sources close to the investigation. The Mainichi newspaper alone in 1 week used that phrase 58 times. Why? Because you can't name the police officers that are talking to you about cases in progress or they go to jail. Anybody who says that it's mysterious to Japan as anonymous sources either is stupid because they don't know the Japanese law, or they're malicious because they do know and they're pretending that it's a big deal.
Do you ever just get the impression that the ideas that Japanese people have about kojin joho, personal information, are just way more strict than they are in the West? When I was a teacher at junior high school, I was always shocked that, you know, you're never going to give out any information at all. You're never going to say a person's name. You take a picture of somebody, you want to upload that onto Facebook, you're blurring out, for example, for your kid, like you go to a little league ball game or something like that. You take a picture of your kid kicking a ball or hitting a ball. You have to blur out everybody else, all the other kids, everybody. It's like,
It didn't used to be this way. The root of all evil is a law called the Kojin Joho Hogoho, the Personal Privacy Protection Act, which was enacted by the LDP after former Prime Minister Mori got tired of newspapers writing about his past dalliances with prostitutes and organized crime figures. And so they came up with this law to protect the personal privacy of people. It should be called the Politicians Protection Law. And it has been a huge detriment to investigative journalism and common sense. So blame it all on pinhead Prime Minister Mori, who was tired of people dragging up his scandals. That's why we have that.
Waseda graduate and a rugby player, if I remember correctly.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's the best thing you can say about him.
I mean, yeah. Like, go ahead, Trevor.
I was just going to say, I'm kind of surprised that there are that many police officers or investigators that are willing to risk those kind of, you know, repercussions and still speak with reporters. You know, well, even
it's tradition, right? You know, we're in the press club. It's everybody understands the wink, wink, nod, nod, right? But in the cases where there have been slip ups, the results have been devastating. I think, forgive me if I'm getting the year wrong. In 2012, a reporter from the Yomiuri in Fukuoka accidentally sent out an email to a bunch of people that named his source, which was a cop who had been giving information about corruption in the police force. So, you know, you have this whistleblower in the police force. The reporter accidentally names them. Of course, they make him resign. But I think he was really fired, but they made him resign. But the police officer who got named, you know, well, he's basically been outed as someone who's violating the law and, you know, betraying the blue wall. But basically, he's been branded criminal. He tried to kill himself. That tells you how serious that problem could be when it actually rears its ugly head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's interesting. And I'd like to know what the motivation is on the, you know, police officer's side for putting that information forward. Is it, did you ever get a sense? Is it because they feel like this information should be out there, or
there's two things. One is you're just friendly with each other, right? And it's been done for so many years that they, you know, sometimes for the police, you know, as long as people are writing about the crime and it hasn't been solved, that reminds people that it's an issue, and then it brings information to them.
So
for the police, that's, you know, it's a good deal. You know, and we in the media, you know, the media is, you know, and they are very good at manipulating the media. You know that, you know, if everybody has the same press release, the amount of coverage we're going to give the newspaper is very tiny. But if they make the reporter think that they have a scoop, they have something that nobody else does, they'll devote much more space to the story. So there's that as well. And in the old days when reporters were more proactive, sometimes, you know, we would bring information to the police, which would help them make a good case. And as a gesture of thanks, they would feed you a scoop.
Tit for tat.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So there is tangible benefit. Yeah.
Okay. Let's go ahead and keep moving down the list. I've got more questions.
Okay.
From a journalist to a journalist. This is journalist and AI Transform podcast host, Dave McCombs.
Okay.
And Dave asks, how have your sources developed over the years since you reported Tokyo Vice? Have you been able to expand your insider network within the police and the Yakuza?
Well, you know, it's good. I know, Dave, it's a good question. You know, sadly, as the Yakuza fade out, and I moved to writing for the Daily Beast and Asia Times, which and I did a stint for the LA Times for a year. You know, I'm covering more political, social issues, so my days as a police reporter are not what they used to be. So I've kept up those police contacts, and I've kept up, I've kept the contacts with people in the underworld, but, you know, they're fading out quite quickly. I mean, there were 80,000 of them in 2011. Now there's really probably 10,000 left. So the amount of importance they have in Japanese society is much less. In terms of my network, you know, I now have a better network of people who were prosecutors, who are prosecutors, lawyers, politicians on both sides, nonprofit organizations, labor unions like Posse. You know, you need a wide range of sources to cover social issues in Japan. So definitely, you know, my circle of sources has changed quite a bit. You know, I have like a, you know, I've joined the digital age, so I've taken all my business cards and phone numbers and put them into one giant database. So it's quite useful. But, you know, I probably now have literally an entire box of like 10,000 business cards. And of those, there's probably maybe 200, you know, active sources. It's hard to maintain an information network. I did go with one of my cop friends from years ago to see Tokyo Vice at a movie theater. Did you know they were showing the first episode at the Marunouchi Piccadilly?
Nice. How's that?
It was very interesting because, you know, he's known me since like 2002. You know, and he knows the story behind the story. So he was like, yeah, you know, there were some good moments there. I want to see what happens next, but I'm never going to pay for Wow Wow. And I'm like, well, you know, maybe you should think about paying. So, you know, he was like, you know, it was surprisingly realistic. He thought Ansel's Aikido was pretty good. But you know, the funny part was when we were leaving the theater, we ran into one of the actors who plays a Yakuza on the TV series. So, you know, we're all doing introductions and, you know, the guy gives him his card and says, yeah, I play a Yakuza on the series. And then the detective gave him his business card and said, yeah, I arrest Yakuza in real life and throw them in jail. And I thought there was something wonderfully surreal about that moment.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's crazy. I didn't know that it played in a theater in Tokyo. That's awesome. That sounds like a really awesome experience to have, and yeah, a very surreal experience too. Just you must have felt like I finally come into my own. Like writing a book, you probably had that same sensation. Like I did it. The book is out there. It's a success. But you probably feel the same way right now. Like I did it. You know, this is a major stepping stone in your life.
Well, it's very surreal. Because, you know, there are portions of the, you know, of those episodes I'm watching, like the test taking thing. You know, the first time I saw the test taking thing, you know, it was before the series aired because I had to check things. I mean, it was so right, like so good at representing that time that I actually broke up in a cold sweat. I felt like nauseous, like it was just like taking the test again. And the scene where the other Jake goes to visit the house of the detective and he brings them ice cream, you know, that was, you know, that actually happened. So that was like watching, it was like, you know, like I'm, you know, you're like peering into an alternative universe and watching this played out with somebody else. And I was like, this is pretty freaky. I'm very happy with the series. I knew that JT would do it well. I didn't think it would be so amazing and so realistic and in the end so clearly place so much importance on the craft of journalism and not just, you know, adventure and sensationalism and thrills. It's a very well done series.
I'd have to agree. Next question, also from Dave McCones. Speaking of journalism, what's your greatest strength as a journalist?
That I don't forget. That I don't forget, and I stay on stories. I stay on stories for years and years, because I want to know. The story of the liver transplant of Goto Tadamasa, I think I started on that story in 2005, and I wasn't able to really write it until 2008. Maybe 2004. You know, sometimes the important stories don't come easily, and it takes years and years to be able to write them. And I think that's, you know, one of my greatest strengths. And the other great strength I would like to believe I have is that I understand the importance of reciprocity in Japanese society. I mean, it is both a trap and a blessing, but you have to remember, you know, who has done favors for you, and you have to pay them back. And sometimes when it comes time to pay them back, it's at a very inconvenient time, but that becomes the measure of who you are. Do you remember the debts you're owed, and do you pay them back? So in Japan, where people have a sense of honor, I don't know how this would work in the United States, but that's an asset.
Yeah, that's great. It sounds like, you know, you mentioned memory, but I think tenacity also, memory and tenacity. Great qualities as a journalist. Last question from Dave McCombs. Do you ever get, this is an interesting question because I think it's almost, if you view it like a mirror, it might say more about David McCombs than about you, but it's an interesting question nonetheless.
All right.
Do you ever get a sense that the other foreign journalists in Tokyo are a little envious of your success?
I get that sense from a few, like not only envious, but wish me ill, which is always kind of a shock. I mean, but mostly I think people are really supportive, and I have always tried to work with other journalists. You know, if someone calls me up and says, like, hey, I'm working on a story about, you know, the Yakuza, can you give me a quote, or can you connect me to someone who would be good for a quote? I mean, I almost always do. I'm very cooperative. I mean, I have an area of expertise, but I'm not an asshole about it. So if someone calls me and says, you know, I'm working on this, can you connect me to somebody? I'll say, yeah, you should try this person or this person. Now, I might not do that for journalists I don't know, I've never met in my life, because it's time consuming. And if they screw it up, you know, your source gets mad at you. But I do that. A homicide detective once said to me that the motives for murder in Japan were kane ona enkon. Kane ona enkon. So kane is, you know, money, right? Greed. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets it. Ona, I mean, he's a Japanese homicide cop, so he's a sexist, right? That's love, you know, affairs of the heart. It just means woman, right? It's a derogatory term for a woman, ona, but you know, that's what he said. And then enkon is an interesting one, because enkon isn't just hatred, it's envy. It's like this envy of someone's success or how they're doing it, and that drives people to murder in this country. And, you know, as years go by, I understand it. Envy can drive people to not only, you know, to be jealous of your success, but to wish you harm. And you're kind of like, you know, that's a strange thing to run into, but it happens.
Yeah, I think the more successful you are, you know, obviously the more envy and possible like trolling and hatred you're going to get. So this new HBO series is probably both a blessing and a curse in that manner. So
yeah, you're absolutely right about that.
Okay, next question is by Ted Bana, PhD, former police translator and friend of an Oyabun in Kyushu, he tells me.
All right.
Ted's been on the show a couple times. He's a really good guy. And Ted asks, does the Yakuza still have any place in society? I would have thought that'd be a do, but I don't have a PhD. Do the Yakuza still have any place in society? It used to be, I don't know, maybe there's no plural there. It used to be that you went to one of them when the authorities wouldn't help. Have they completely morphed into criminal activities or kept any traditional pre-modern elements?
Well, mostly they have been made obsolete by an increased number of lawyers. There's actually an amazing correlation between the number of lawyers growing and the number of Yakuza being reduced. So all the, you know, things that you used to use Yakuza for to solve your problems, civil disputes, evicting tenants, you can get a lawyer to do for you now, and there are more lawyers. With cameras everywhere now, their role is sort of keeping the peace and keeping street crime down. They're not needed for that anymore. There's very little use for them. They are gradually obsolete. The generosity that they might have been able to display has been destroyed by the fact that they just can't operate their business. And it's now a crime to pay off the Yakuza, so people don't pay them off. So the classic model of what we might call the harmless Yakuza was you paid them protection money in your neighborhood. And in turn, it wasn't very much. They were like a sort of sekkom, like a cheap sekkom. If you had a customer that was causing trouble, they would come and kick the customer out, and they'd make them pay damages if they'd done any damage to your shop. And people felt it was worth it. But now, everything is franchises, and the need for them is less. So when there's disasters, they still do the things that they earned a reputation for doing, which is send relief to the disaster-stricken areas very quickly and efficiently, because they don't have any red tape, and also because it's good publicity. But essentially, there's no place for the left of them in Japanese society. The numbers keep going down every year. Did you know, you probably do, that the average age of a Yakuza is now 50? Now, I am 53, so I feel like I am fading out with these guys.
I didn't know that. But yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, not only is their role in society declining, but their ability to do anything is also declining as the numbers decline. So like after the Kansai earthquake, I mean, I wasn't there, but apparently they helped out quite a bit when the government was largely unresponsive. I'm not sure they'd be able to mobilize such help today, given the falling numbers of the Yakuza.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'm not going to be sad to see them go, but I have all these fan magazines and videos and paraphernalia, and I'm like, you know, I'm going to toss it out. I'm going to open a Yakuza museum. I'm probably going to open a Yakuza museum someday.
That'd be great. I'd visit.
I have this great plan. It'll be free. It'll say free at the entrance, but as you leave, we'll have like 3x Yakuza there with like the donations jar, and no matter what you put in the jar, they'll just give you a hard time, like, oh, you didn't like it? What did you like? You weren't satisfied? Why aren't you satisfied? Everybody else is satisfied. And they'll make you so uncomfortable that you'll put in more money than you want to. And as you leave, you'll know, like, oh, this is what it's really like to deal with the Yakuza. So, you know, it'd be a great experience.
Classic fleecing. Yeah, love it. All right. Next question from cross-cultural communication instructor Nicholas Gaddig. Gaddig says, as you know, things have changed since Tokyo Vice was written. In today's climate, how can a foreign journalist do investigative journalism in a country that seems so intent on consigning investigative journalism to irrelevance? Japan has made it basically illegal to blow the whistle on government wrongdoings. And as a foreign journalist, it seems even harder to get access to and access to uncover things. Is it even possible for Jake Adelstein to exist in 2022? Could someone like you exist in 2022, Jake?
Yes, they could exist, but even basically you need to be on the inside first. I'm sorry to say it's really helpful to be on the inside first so you can build up those connections and those sources. So you are a member of the press club. You serve your time doing grunt work and learning the ropes and the connections and how to read real estate deeds and corporate registrations. And if you have that base, I think you could. Coming from nothing, and even with incredible fluency in Japanese, and even if you could teach yourself, you know, the basic investigative journalism here, how to access government records, how to read a real estate deed, how to read a corporate ledger, how to build up sources, it's very hard. I mean, I had a wonderful advantage that I had 12 years inside of the Omiri to make contacts and get to know people and learn the ropes and learn the process of investigative journalism. So I don't think I would have been able to exist outside of that world if I hadn't been on the inside first. Let me tell you, it's very easy when you're in the press club to, you know, not necessarily to get a scoop, but at least to do detailed writing because people are cooperative to some extent. When you're on the outside, you know, they barely give you the time of day.
No, yeah, that makes sense. All right, I've got a few more questions from listeners, and then we're going to change gears a bit. The next question is from DIJ podcast listener and guest Josh Howley, and he asks, how has Japan improved its record on human trafficking since you wrote the book?
Oh, tremendously. For years I worked with Lighthouse, which used to be called Polaris Project Japan, and this year they've basically closed shop. And they closed shop because the number of foreign women trafficked in Japan has dramatically reduced, and even domestic trafficking is while it's still a problem, it isn't what it was. I think that the Japanese government, once they put laws on the books and began enforcing them and really throttled the entertainer visas, which were being abused, and this kind of lobby of human traffickers was called Zengeiren, disbanded. If you read the book, Zengeiren used to have their meetings at the Liberal Democratic Party headquarters. Abe hosted one of them, just saying. But they were a conduit between traffickers and entertainment brokers and other things, a very powerful organization. They've been disbanded. And, you know, with a change in laws, it makes human trafficking a very expensive proposition, and especially if you get caught, you know. Most organized crime groups have moved away from it. So things have, you know, Japan can change for the better. And in terms of dealing with human trafficking, especially the trafficking of women for sexual slavery has really been reduced. Now, if you want to talk about labor exploitation, including the screwed up intern system here, that's a whole other problem. But what we typically define as human trafficking is, sexual exploitation of men and women for that purpose. That has been dramatically reduced in Japan.
That's great news. I mean, I haven't been to a club or anything like that in like decades. I'm a family man with, you know, a wife and kids. But does that mean that if I go down to a local snack or something like that, I'm not going to be bumping into Filipina hostesses, or they're just not being brought over under duress or false pretenses?
Yeah, they're not being brought over under duress or false pretenses. And then most of the people who are working here are either they're legitimately married or they're in a very good fake marriage, and so they can't be coerced into doing work they don't want to do, but with the threat of being turned over to the police and exiled for violating their visa.
That's good news.
So that was always the weakness for women had, is right, you know, because, you know, even if they were victimized, technically they're violating their visa, right? Because you can't work in the sex industry or the adult entertainment industry on any visa. So, you know, if they went to the police to, you know, say, rescue me, there's not much the police could do except, especially in the early days, like, deport them. You can't build a case if they're deported. There was no mechanism for prosecuting human trafficking. And once those laws were on the books and they began going after the traffickers, especially Nagano Prefecture was very good about that.
Yay, Nagano.
Yeah. Good for Nagano. Nagano was like way ahead of everybody else. And once they began doing that, it kind of vanished as a lucrative field for the underworld.
I'm glad to hear that Nagano has something it can put its name to other than being the second largest prefecture in Japan. That's great. We have something to be proud of. I didn't know that.
Hosted the Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
The Winter Olympics. Come on.
Right. And the first,
yeah, the best Olympics.
The first prefecture to successfully bribe the IOC into getting the Olympics, and, you know, that would be Nagano Prefecture.
Exactly.
Touche.
Yeah. Okay. We got two more questions from listeners. The next one is from Jed Shepler.
Okay.
And he asks, do you think the Yakuza will be pressured into irrelevance, legal conformity, and reinvention, or will selection pressures promote their evolution into something more insidious and dangerous?
At one time I would have argued, you know, I would have taken the view that, yeah, they're going to turn into something more insidious and dangerous. But in this day and age, in a 24-hour surveillance society, I just think they're going to be pushed into irrelevance. You know, they talk about like Hangure and these other, like, you know, half, you know, ex-Yakuza outlaw groups, but come up and, you know, pull off some spectacular crimes, but the police grab them very fast. They don't even last a year, maybe half a year. Just, you know, everybody is monitored. There are cameras everywhere. Technology is wonderful. You can track people on their phones. It's easy to wiretap now. Organized crime doesn't have a chance here in Japan, so I cannot see the Yakuza morphing into something more powerful, more stronger, more dangerous. They will just continue to fade out, and I don't think anything will really replace them.
So wait a minute. The TDP, then, are they not using Windows 7 and Yahoo Search, then? Have they upped their game? Do they have a lot of tech these days?
They have upped their game, man. You know, people make fun of the TMPD because to ask them questions, they still require you to send faxes and things. But
properly Honcode faxes, yeah.
but the thing about a fax is, if it's disconnected from your computer system, it's the most safe thing in the world. Because you can't send a virus via a fax unless you send, like, you know, a fax that says, please go to this URL here, and they type it in, right? Japan gets much better at dealing with high tech crimes, though. If you look at the backlog that happened with Mt. Gox, you know they may not quite be up there yet, but they're getting better. And I heard that some computers even have the latest version of Netscape Navigator. So, you know, moving on.
Wow. That's impressive. Okay, last question. I don't know if he actually listens to the show, but he does participate in the show. Our curmudgeon friend and fellow co-host, Steve Edwards, asks, the last year of your life must have been amazing, having the book get picked up by HBO. But tell us, what was the most, quote-unquote, ichiban saiko no hi of this whole endeavor? Sorry to mix in Japanese with the... He hates it when I do this. Steve does not understand Japanese at all, but he watched the HBO show.
The best day of the last year was meeting my girlfriend Jesse Nakamura on Bumble, and going out to dinner at Cafe 8 and immediately hitting it off.
Nice.
And being very, very glad that, you know, I didn't know anything about her except that her profile picture was very fun. Her doing like lots of crazy activities like skateboarding and snowboarding, and that she had a black belt in Kyokushin Ryu Karate. So I knew we have karate in common. And then I also realized that she was like at least 6 or 7 centimeters taller than me. And I'm like, I hope that she's okay with me being shorter, which she was. So that was the best thing. I mean, there are many things that were great. You know, having my kids here for the premiere was wonderful. Finishing my second book was wonderful. But that evening when me and Jesse met up, and there was magic as we were eating duck under the giant penis at the Cafe 8 in Roppongi. That was the best day.
There's something magical about eating under a giant penis. So,
I'm leaving out details, especially when it has Christmas lights around it and you're the only people in the restaurant, and it's next to this giant bell with a vulva, you know, embedded in the bell. It's, you know, I think some people miss the charm of Cafe 8's interior decor, but I felt like, you know, this is the luckiest day of my life.
And
the duck was really good too.
Congratulations to you and her. I wasn't going to go too personal in this interview, but since you did bring up Jesse, I think I might as well go ahead and ask this next question, which wasn't on the document that I sent you. Some people have told me that maybe you're engaged. Is that so? And if so, can you comment on it?
We are not engaged. She is divorced and not thinking of getting remarried. So we are, you know, we're just taking it as it goes, but definitely, probably going to be together, you know, until I croak, because and there's like a 17 year age gap there. So I don't think I'm going to outlive her.
Right on. Well, I wish you nothing but success in your relationship endeavors. All right, we're gonna change gears. We've gotten through that long list of questions from the listeners, Jake. Thank you. I kind of want to let's see here. I don't want to ask any more questions about the Yakuza. Let's skip the methamphetamines. Do you want to talk about prostitution? Maybe we could skip that too. I don't know. We did talk about Polaris, so we can probably skip that. I really wanted to talk about press freedom, though, Jake. So maybe we could talk about that. Not that, you know, prostitution and methamphetamines and the Yakuza aren't great topics in and of themselves, but we can circle back to that if we need to.
Okay.
So I recently watched your TEDx Haneda talk from back in 2016. And, you know, you've got a ton of videos up on YouTube, and it was fun to watch them all in preparation for this. But that one in specific, I thought would be a great piece to talk about, because you outlined the erosion of press freedom in Japan. And that was 6 years ago. So my question is, what's it like now? Has the situation changed? Has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse? How do you feel about press freedom in Japan in 2022?
Well, I see some encouraging signs, in the sense that Bunshun is doing this, you know, hard-hitting reporting that is causing things to change. And other newspaper outlets are realizing, you know, no one is going to trust us if we don't actually do our work, right? You know, people are tired of being fed the party line. And with Abe out of power and Kishida not being as much of a vicious asshole, I think the media is, you know, finding some of its strengths. But it has been really co-opted. As people are reading the newspapers less, there's less money to spend on investigative journalism. So there are also things that make me, you know, worry about, you know, how will the Japanese, how will the Japanese press do? Will they find the job? And but the most worrying thing about press freedom in Japan is this, is that there is no punishment for the crimes that people are committing. Meaning that, you know, Abe breaks the law. Amari clearly breaks the law. You know, the Carlos Ghosn case is a fiasco. Political donations laws are broken. And, you know, rarely does anyone pay the price. And if people can break the law, flout the law, with, for example, the whole tragic thing about the Moritomo Gakuen, in which, you know, this bureaucrat killed himself because he didn't want to be part of a cover-up. And everybody knows there was a cover-up. Everybody knows that, you know, there are documents. Everybody knows that the Ministry of Finance, you know, broke the law, bended the law to benefit one of Abe's political cronies, right? But no one is punished. No one loses their job. Everybody who's in on the fix gets promoted. So when good people are punished and bad people are rewarded for breaking the law and the prosecutors don't do their job, then, you know, the media has a problem because if there's, you know, part of the idea is you report the truth, it gets discovered, then there's, you know, then justice happens, right? But if justice doesn't take place, if the prosecutors don't do their job, and criminals get away scot-free, then the meaning of what you do seems to vanish because you write and you write and you expose these wrongdoings, but nothing changes. No one is punished. And that's the real problem that people are facing here, and it's disillusioning.
And how about the state secrets law? I forget the name of it. The state secrets law?
Tokutei Himitsu Hokuho or something like that.
Is that still on the books? And has
it's still on. No one has been nailed for it yet, but it, you know, it remains there like this invisible cloud over people's head. And the scariest thing about that law is that for asking a question about a state secret, that can be instigating a leak and you can be sent to jail for 5 years. And of course, no, you know, if you're put on trial, that you can't, they won't discuss what was the state secret that you were instigating a leak of. It's a terribly written law. And it is ripe for abuse, and someday it will be abused.
It's absolutely frightening when you see it and you hear about it, especially how you explain it in that talk. It sounds like it would just create an oppressive atmosphere where journalism can't flourish and be free. You know. So, I mean, that's why Japan is still 66 out of 180 in terms of rankings for press freedom today.
I think one of the most shocking things that I've ever seen is that, and I think people should watch this, there is a meeting held, I think, around 2000, I think it's like 2012, of a Nippon Kaigi, like this conservative lobby, one of their subgroups. There's Abe is there. At the time, he's still not prime minister. Abe is there. His former minister of justice is there. A lot of the people in the cabinet are at this meeting, and the former Minister of Justice appointed by Abe gets up and he says, you know, Japan can't be an independent great nation again until we get rid of this U.S. opposed consciousness and purge ourselves of basic human rights, popular sovereignty, and pacifism. And I was like, you know, and everyone applauds. And I'm like, okay, you just had a guy say that, you know, to make Japan a great nation, you need to get rid of basic human rights, basically democracy, and you know, the non-war clause in the Constitution. And I'm like, well, that's a recipe for totalitarianism if you ever heard of one. And you know, that's the agenda.
It sounds like an imperialist throwback, right? Like somebody who wants to reinstate, you know, the emperor system or something like that.
Yeah.
Complete anachronism.
And the irony of wanting to reinstate the emperor system is both the current emperor and the emperor before him are these incredibly liberal pacifists who, I think the previous emperor is on record saying, you know, we're very thankful that after the war, people who understood that Japan brought us a constitution that promoted basic human rights, popular sovereignty, and peace. You know, I mean, you can't get more liberal than that. So it's a very, that's also always amuses me. You have the right wing that wants to install the emperor as the ultimate authority, and the emperor and the emperor himself is a staunch believer in a liberal democracy where human rights are guaranteed. Go figure.
Well, it sounds like, you know, you outlined some promising things about press freedom, but it sounds like Japan is still pretty much in the dumps in that department. Do you have high hopes for, you know, the long game? Do you see another sort of, I don't know, Taisho democratic future for Japan where it flourishes?
Well, you know, it took, you know, decades before people kicked the Liberal Democratic Party out of power, which was in 2009. And Japan showed remarkable improvement in a lot of areas, including gender equality, including press freedom. And then, you know, the nuclear disaster happened, and the people who were, you know, holding the bag at the time got blamed for it. So I really think until you see, the LDP kicked out of power once again, there's not really much hope for change in Japan. Just going to continue, you know, its downward spiral. I wish I would be more optimistic, but I just see Japan, you know, going down as the value of the yen keeps going down as well. So, you know, so there we are.
Yeah. Plus, it feels like really liberal democracies all around the world are becoming a little bit more rightist and conservative. And maybe that has to do with global chaotic factors like global warming, you know, et cetera. Maybe there's something underlying all that. But I feel like we're in this global movement towards a more rightist trajectory. It seems that way to me anyway.
Well, I mean, it does feel like that, but it doesn't sort of, you know, I feel like that's a cycle that keeps getting repeated as you go to the far right, things get more conservative.
The pendulum.
You realize the pendulum, you know, they help themselves to all the money they can grab. People realize, hey, this is not fair. They get thrown out, you know, things get a little better. Mm-hmm. And then everybody forgets why they threw out the people in the first place.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope it swings back. I feel like I've had enough of this ride, so let's change. I've already taken up so much of your time, Jake, so I feel like I really want to be mindful of that. I just have a few more questions on the personal front for you. Every time I catch an update from you on Facebook, I feel like you're eating ice cream and having fun with friends. You're always smiling. It seems like you're having a great time. But other than having luscious meals of duck with your girlfriend under giant penises in Cafe 8, what do you do in your free time?
Oh, I go to the gym a lot because
you're a gym rat.
I'm a gym rat, man. I'm a gym rat. I'm looking for I wanted to start up martial arts again, but because of the pandemic, a lot of places were closed. So now that we're not even out of the pandemic, but everyone seems to be ignoring it, I'll probably start a martial art again. So I go to gym rat. I'm a gym rat. I read a lot. And then I also am a Zen Buddhist priest, so I have training. And, you know, that's not very exciting to take pictures of. So learning sutras and doing rituals and learning to cook Buddhist vegetarian food. I'm way behind on my training. It's being a Zen Buddhist priest is like the Marines. If you don't move up after 10 years, then you're out. You know, you have to make the next level. So pretty soon I'm going to have to start trying to solve one of those crazy Zen riddles, like what is the sound of one hand clapping? Not looking forward to it. I thought, like, aren't I in the school of Zen where we don't have to deal with that stuff? Isn't that like the Rinzai people? But apparently not.
Buddhism was actually one of the questions I had for you coming up. But now that you've talked about being a gym rat, I have some other questions for you.
Oh, here we go.
And you mentioned the koan, the sound of one hand clapping. Just a personal aside, at the most recent company retreat that I had, I was in a car with two guys with my company. One of them was this huge Canadian guy who was a football player. He played professionally in Canada, and then he came down to the United States. Or maybe he played in college. I don't know if Canada has a professional football team, but he played ball professionally in the United States. And he's like, "Do you want to know what the sound of one hand clapping is, bro?" And I was like, "Okay, yeah, sure." we weren't talking about Buddhism or koans or anything. He just like hit me up with that question. I was like, "Yeah, sure. What is the sound of one hand clapping?" He opens up this hand of his, this giant fucking massive hand, and he starts clapping his own single hand and making it a sound. And I was like, oh shit, he solved the koan. His body solved the koan. But anyway, that's completely irrelevant.
Actually, that is no. But I should correct you.
Can you do that? I know you have ignorance too, right?
No, I do. But that is not the right answer.
What is the answer to that riddle?
The right answer is you slap the person across the face, and that is the sound of one hand clapping.
I should have slapped you. Damn it.
Yeah. It's probably the best joke in Zen Buddhism. What is the sound of one hand? That's the answer. They slap you across the face.
That is awesome.
Or you slap them across the face. But
Yeah.
Like many things in Japan. Apparently there are the answers written down somewhere, but nobody is supposed to admit that there actually is a written down answer somewhere, because it would be okay, this whole thing is a farce. But I've heard rumors.
Eventually, if you keep following your sources and being an investigative journalism, eventually you'll get your hands on that document, Jake, and you can unravel that for us as well. But speaking of gyms and being a gym rat, I wanted to ask you, bro, how much do you bench?
I don't bench much at all, man. So here's my problem, right? I've had my ass kicked so many times. The problem with dealing with violent people, right? The term for Yakuza in Japanese is Boryokudan, and that's the police word, which means literally violent groups, is they're violent. And over the last 30 years of reporting on these guys, I've been in several unpleasant encounters, and as I get older, I've got lots of injuries. So I'm doing lots of reps. I do 40 reps of 20 kilos, because otherwise I'm in pain the rest of the day. I'm sorry, I don't bench much.
Well, it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek question anyway.
Jeff, I feel like really? That was the first question you met me when we met. You were like, do you even lift, bro? What do you bench? Do you want to come into my garden shack? I've got a rack.
Yeah, we had some moments in there.
I can bench 25 kilos, and I feel like I'm Schwarzenegger. I'm like, oh, 25. No, not much.
That's enough for most practical applications. I think you'll be fine. Jake, tell us about your family. I know you got a couple kids. You talk about them in the book, but the book was written forever ago, so they must be big now, right? How old are your kids? Do you get to see them? Are they in Japan? Where are they located?
So they're living in the United States. Before the pandemic, I got to see them quite often. But as you know, even if you're a permanent resident, there was this period of time where if you went back, they wouldn't let you in. So I was like, I can't go home. So my daughter is 21. She's in university. She's pre-med.
Wow. Nice.
We're in communication quite a lot. I took her to France with me when the last Yakuza came out in 2017. We spent 2 weeks there together. And she was so enamored of Europe that she decided to spend a year studying in Spain, which she did. Ray is going to be 18. He is, really into karate. He's got a black belt. It took him years to get a black belt because he went to one of those schools where it's they don't hand them out like candy. He's taller than me. He is incredibly stoic. He's his older sister drives me up the wall. I mean, I think the greatest challenge in my spiritual training was when we were heading to France. I'd just taken my Buddhist priest vows. I got 2 weeks with my daughter, and she said, Dad, you think that I don't pay attention to what you write or what you tell me, but I do. And I looked up the 10 precepts that you have to follow as a Zen Buddhist priest. And I was really touched. I'm like, that's amazing, Benny. And she's like, do you remember what number 9 is? And I said, yes, number 9 is not to give in to anger. And she said, well, that's going to be an interesting 2 weeks. And it was really hard. It's really hard.
Your son also looks a lot like you. I've seen pictures, and it's like, wow, he looks like the spitting image of you.
Yeah, he is. He is. He is everything I wanted to be at 17 or 18. And he's self-possessed. He's very good at the martial arts. He got into WashU with a good scholarship. He's very bright, and he's unshakable. He also has a very droll sense of humor. They're both great kids. And one of the, for me that I hadn't been home in 2 years, and I saw Benny in Spain as Tokyo Vice came out in Spain, last September. And I was like, Benny, like, you know, you can go visit your host family in Spain. Like, I've got a hotel for 2 weeks, so come, I'll get your ticket. And so we hung out, but I hadn't seen Ray in face to face in a long time. So they both came here for the premiere of the show. And, you know, and they got to meet, I mean, they already knew JT, but they got to meet Ansel, and they got to meet Alan Poole, who's one of the producers and also directors. And
oh, that must have been a treat for them.
Oh yeah, they had a great time. They had a really wonderful yeah. time. It was, you know, and Denny said, you know, Dad, this almost makes up for you abandoning us most of our lives. And I was like, thanks, Ben. That's really nice of you to say.
That's a sharp comment.
Yeah, like I said, my kids are the kids are funny and they're brutal, you know.
They seem really happy and well adjusted too. Like every photograph I've seen of them with you, you guys look like you always look just incredibly happy. Like the impression that I have of you is that you're just walking on sunshine all day, every day.
We have a very nice rapport.
That's good.
You know, I mean, I don't talk about philosophy very much, but. In 2011, right after, you know, I came back, you know, on the big earthquake day, right, the day that everybody remembers, where was I? I was in New York at the Japan Society Yakuza Film Festival giving a lecture. So I wasn't anywhere near where that happened. It took me like a week to get home. So I got home and, you know, all the lights were off and, it, you know, it was chaos and people wondering whether there'd be another nuclear disaster. And then the first thing I got when I got home, when I opened my mail, there was results of my Ningen Doku, which is like my my physical, which is like, hi, you probably have liver cancer. It's like a 3.6 centimeter tumor. Yes, you should probably come in and get that looked at. And it turned out to be cancer, but it was really early, so they were able to do this really weird procedure on it called percutaneous ethanol injection. Where they inject alcohol into the liver. That sounds kind of homeopathic, right? But that kind of worked. And then I had chemo for a while. But after that experience, you know, after that harsh year, and I can't say that 2012 was really great either. You know, I just sort of wake up every day, like with the opposite of the Apache, you know, morning pep talk to themselves, like, oh, today is a great day not to be dead. So compared to, you know, being on chemo every day, I wake up that I'm like not feeling awful. I'm like, yeah, I'm happy. You know, you just need a standard of comparison.
Sure. You know? Yeah. That sounds rough.
So I'm generally cheerful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can see how that might have given you a sunny disposition.
My father's a coroner, right? He's like 83 now. And, you know,
yeah,
and he's the most cheerful guy. I mean, he's still chopping up dead bodies and, you know, and he's like, son, yeah, I keep looking at these people and I'm going like, you know, like, oh yeah, like I used to know that guy. And he's like, you know, yeah, I feel like that, you know, the character in the, you know, that, you know, children's book, your sister has the one, like with the dinosaur on it, like all my friends are dead. And he said, but I'm still alive. And so I'm happy.
Oh,
and I'm
like, my God. That's so macabre.
Well, you know, death is a part of life, and if you're covering crime, or and I've been doing that, you know, it's still part of my beat for 30 years. You know, you know, being alive is certainly something to be cheerful about.
Definitely, yeah. I didn't realize that injecting your liver with alcohol is a way to combat liver cancer, but I have some friends who do that quite regularly. You know, orally, obviously, they're not injecting directly into the liver.
According to the Ministry of Health and Welfare standards, it has to be under 3.0 centimeters. And at that point, it's the tumor is self-contained enough where the alcohol basically fills up the tumor and kills it, but doesn't kill the surrounding tissue. So it does work surprisingly well, but you have to catch it really early, which is hard because liver cancer is often asymptomatic.
Crazy. Well, Jake, last question for you. Let's talk a little bit more about Buddhism. You've talked about it a bit. We know that you are a legitimate like priest in Buddhism, but tell me what it means to you. What does Buddhism mean to you personally? And what is your favorite Buddhist sutra or parable?
Okay, so You know, first of all, my Zen Buddhist name, my kaimyo, is Ryojo. It's actually Joshu Ryojo, but I just go by Ryojo for short. The Ryo is taken from my Zen master. It's not a really good word for a Hojo-san in English, so I'll just say Zen master. My master's name, it has the character Yoi in it, so I take, usually you take one character from your master's name, so it's Ryo. And then Jo, it means like, it's a really difficult kanji, but it means yurayaka, or to do things slowly. So my Buddhist name literally means to do good at a leisurely pace. I don't know if that's the greatest Buddhist name ever, but it's not bad. I like it as a philosophy, and you know, the story of how I ended up taking the Buddhist priest vows is very long, longer than this podcast, but you know, I'm glad that I did it. And you know, the basic philosophy of Buddhism I like, you know, which is that you know, we suffer because we're greedy and we want things that we can't have, and we're not happy with what we want to have. And if we stop being greedy and ignorant and full of hatred, that we can achieve happiness in this lifetime, and that happiness may be something that transcends reincarnation. Zen Buddhism is very vague about the metaphysics of it. There's lots of rituals you do, but you're not really required to believe. It's not a matter of faith. It's a matter of upholding these, you know, 10 common sense ethical principles. And I like that philosophy. It's nice to have a philosophy to live by. Sometimes it's very hard to adhere to those edicts, but I find meaning in it. It's like, you know, even if it's not true, I wish it was true. I wish there was karma in this world. I wish that the good you did came back to you, and that people were punished for the mean, nasty things that they did. I look around the world, and sometimes it's hard to see that, to believe that's true, but sometimes I feel like, yeah, it exists. So that's what Buddhism means to me. My favorite sutra being word for like a Buddhist scripture, is actually the Hokukyo, which is one of the oldest ones, which is, you know, it's like 400, it's like 24 chapters. It's almost like poetry. It has lines like, you know, speak the truth, never be angry, give what you can, and then you are close to being in the presence of the gods. You know, very nice, pithy stuff that's easy to follow, that makes sense. But my favorite like Buddhist saying is this one, because it's very visual and it's also very funny, which is, do not swallow the red hot iron ball and then cry, I am in great pain.
That's it.
That's it.
There's not another line to drop there.
No, I love that. Every time I hear that line, it makes me laugh.
I felt like there was another foot was going to drop. You know, like there's got to be another line here.
No, that's it. That's it.
The Hokukyo sounds like it's like the perfect sutra for a journalist, you know, speak the truth, you know, don't be afraid. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's the one that says, you know, fight anger with love, fight greed with generosity. What is it? Hold on, let me see. I'm trying to remember exactly what it is. Oh yeah. It's fight anger with love. Fight ignorance with knowledge, fight greed with generosity, and fight lies with truth. I mean, pretty much, isn't that like, you know, a great job description?
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like the journalist's job description. Well, hey, I was going to end it, but I know, actually, I just remembered that Trevor has one more burning question for you.
Fire away.
So I'm going to hand that over to Trevor, and then we can wrap this up, boys.
The question was basically answered early on in the conversation we were having about the special. I will ask it though, because I do have a connection with it. But there's a scene early on in the special. This is such a stupid question.
Go ahead.
There's a scene very early on in the special where Taj is at the Hostess Club. I think it's episode 2. And he, this is the first encounter that he has with the Yakuza. And the way he kind of breaks the ice is this kind of innocuous conversation about the Nike shoes that he's wearing. And they kind of have this little back and forth, and it kind of opens up this rapport. And as somebody that's very close to Nike, knows people that would love to know the answer, including myself, I want to know, is there any truth to that story?
The only truth to the story is that you know, my senpai became a yakuza, right? Who has this? Mm-hmm. Who spent time in New York? Who's got this? You know, he's kind of into street fashion. Is that? You know, we met up after years, and we were sitting in a restaurant, and he was, you know, he's bragging about his kicks, and he's like showing me these shoes, and he's like, yeah, you know, he's talking about how much he spent for them, and he's like, and he's, you know, it's, so he's like showing me his kicks, and I think they were really expensive Nikes, and I said, like, oh, are those Adidas? And he was just so insulted. He was like, like, what? Like, he's, what? Are you stupid, motherfucker? Are you making fun of me? Are you making fun of me? And I'm like, dude, like, I don't know anything about shoes. I couldn't give a shit. It's like sports. I don't know anything about sports. Like, you're always talking about sports. I don't care about sports. And I don't care about shoes. But if you say that they're great, valuable shoes, good on you, man.
Oh, I love it. Okay, yeah. I love it. And just especially because I happen to own a pair of the shoes that that Ansel was wearing in that episode. The Nike Dunk Low black and white pandas. Great shoe, valuable shoe. Look great with everything.
Is this a commercial? What is happening right now, Trevor? What's going on?
sorry. We got to rep the brand. It's we're not sponsored by Nike, but, you know, who knows?
We will be.
Who knows what the future holds? Be. Yeah.
My favorite kicks are pair of boots I bought at the Eddie Bauer closing sale this year. It was like, you know, they're really ugly, but they're really comfortable. So there you are.
Functionality. I over style. I'm with you.
No. Style at the price
of pain. I think
what
he said is, and I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, Jake, but I think what he said is, fuck Nike. Anybody who works there, fuck all those people. We do not want Nike as a sponsor of the show. They make the worst shoes. Screw Nike. I'm pretty sure. I'm directly quoting Jake there.
You know, let me talk to Human Rights Now, and I'll talk to, you know, and see what they have to say about Nike, and then I can give you my opinion on them.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right. Well, hey,
that
guys.
That was my one burning question.
Now you have something to go back to the gang with. So there you go, Trevor. And Jake, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day. I know you're recovering from COVID yourself, so I appreciate you making time for us. I hope that I'm not sick with that. You know?
I hope you're not either. Last word of advice. I really hate to tell people to lie because but in terms of like weighing dying versus lying, sometimes I guess the lie is better. If you try to get tested and you call the Hokkenjo, you need to tell them, yes, I've had a fever of 37.5 for 3 days, because they will not test you unless you say that.
Oh, if you don't have a fever, if you have walking COVID, as it were.
No, Japan still discourages people from getting tested or doesn't want to test them. So, you know, whenever you call, it's like, if you don't have that, like, you know, they'll ask you, like, how long have you had a fever? If you say, like, you don't say 37.5 for 3 days, a lot of times they'll refuse to test you. I got COVID. I told my coworker, you know, one of them got tested. The other one was like, you know, went to some clinic and they was like, I haven't had a fever. And they're like, oh, you know, we're not going to give you a PCR test.
Wow.
It's crazy. So that's my advice.
They're very reluctant to do that. Like one of my kids has, the first person to get sick in the family, my wife took our child to the hospital. Yeah. And they didn't want to test. They're like, no, you know, you haven't had a fever for 3 days, so we're not going to test. So like we might've known if this is in fact, and maybe it's not, maybe we just have a cold. I don't know, but we haven't been tested because we went to the hospital and we were kind of like turned away. So, that's great advice. Maybe if we do have to go back tomorrow, if we're still sick and it's Monday, we'll definitely give them that line that they need, that magical key.
I'll coach you on this. I have not been overseas recently. Someone at my work tested positive on a PCR test. I did the antigen test this morning. It's also positive. I've had a fever for over 3 days of 37.5. And then they're like, okay, you can be tested.
Then maybe you'll get tested. Maybe.
Maybe you'll get tested. Maybe you'll get tested.
Nice.
If they're feeling generous. But believe me, that's the only way. And you should get tested because it's nice to know.
Sure.
You know, it's nice to know that it's not in your head. It's kind of like, okay, the antigen test says positive. Maybe, I don't know. Let's go find out. it's worth it. Yeah. You know, because then you can can feel shitty and feel legitimately like it's not in my head. I'm like I'm ill.
Definitely,
it's true. Yeah, as somebody that's been through it, I 100% agree. then when you tell your friend Jeff.
So Jake, one more question. What's next? What's on the horizon for Jake Adelstein?
Well, I'm doing something I've never done before, which is I'm doing a podcast with Campside Media, who brought you great shows like Suspect and Hollywood Chameleon Queen. And the show is about people going missing in Japan.
Oh, wow.
Because every year, 80,000 people are reported missing. And who are these people? Why do they go missing? And how many of them are missing of their own volition? I've got a crew of at least two people I'm working with on this, Shoko Plombeck and Tisanka Sudipala. We're hoping to air it by the end of this year or next year. And that's what I'm focusing on. So we're interviewing people like night movers, people who have disappeared, people who have loved ones disappear because the loved ones have dementia.
Sure. Yeah. That is awesome. In the book, you talk about Helena, who was a missing person referenced in the book a number of times. Is there any update on that? Are you going to follow up on that? Or is this all more modern, recent stuff?
It's more modern stuff. I think the narrative starts with my accountant who disappeared in 2018 with all my records and the $1,500 that I wired him. Now I have a better idea of what happened to him. And maybe even where he is, and why he went missing. So those kind of stories, those are the, it would be nice to figure out why people go missing and how they go missing. And Japan's a country where it's very easy for people to vanish and stay vanished. Mm-hmm. Which you wouldn't think, right? That you would think Japan would be a place where you, if you tried to restart your life, you could never do it. But, you'd be surprised.
I feel like there's always talk of people getting kidnapped and whatnot and, you know, alerts at school. Oh, there's somebody trying to stick somebody in a van or something like that. What happens to people? Is there an Amber Alert in Japan? And when somebody goes missing, what's the problem? I'd be curious to learn about all that stuff.
If a kid goes missing, Jesus Christ, it's a huge deal. But when, teenager goes missing, less so. And, as I'm finding out that only family members can report somebody missing. So if you put out what's a sosaku negai, you have to be a family member. So if your colleague at work goes missing, you can go to the police, but the police are under no obligation to investigate it. Most of the time they won't. So that is, I think the working title is Kamikakushi, Gone with the Gods.
Kamikakushi, like Sentachihiro no Kamikakushi.
Yeah. Japan has always had a word for people mysteriously disappearing. And, you know, when you have 80,000 disappearing per year, it's not surprising they have a word for it.
Yeah. Wait, that's the title of the podcast, the working title, or the...
Yeah, the working title is Kamikakushi, Gone with the Gods.
Sounds great. Gone with the Gods, sounds great.
I feel like I've read articles on people that will disappear if things get rough at home, or they'll just kind of make themselves vanish. And so, yeah, kind of following up on that, it sounds really interesting to me.
Yeah, I'm joining you guys. I'm doing a podcast. I never thought I would be doing a podcast. And honestly, except I listen to your podcast, I listen to JCR, and I listen to this Japanese podcast called Kyoko Shimbun, which is like a news parody comedy show that's been going on for like years. That's it, you know. Until I got this job, I never listened to like something like Serial or a true crime podcast. And now I am. And now I'm making one. So it's kind of interesting.
That is great news. And I'm happy to hear that you like our podcast. Yeah, I imagine it is. So I'm looking forward to that. And if you ever have any questions, I'm sure you'll be working with professionals, but if you ever have any questions about how to up your audio game, I feel like it's something I struggle with all the time. So if you need any info, let me know.
Oh, yeah. I may ask you questions.
Well, only because you over-engineer, Jeff. That's the reason you struggle so much.
That I do. All right, boys. I don't know about you, but I'm starving.
Okay.
How about we head over to the cafe? What was it called? The Big Dick? We can go meet up for beers later, maybe. How's that?
Cafe 8 in Roppongi.
Cafe 8.
Cafe 8.
Yeah, it's only 4 hours from Nagano, but I'll be there in a couple hours from now if you guys want to have a post-podcast hookup.
It sounds good to me. I doubt that I'm infectious, so let's do that.
I can be there in about 19 hours.
Cool. Perfect. I'll still be there.
All right. We'll still be there.
Hey everybody, this is Jeff again. If you like the show, please give a thought to supporting us at patreon.com. You'll find the link in the show notes. Thank you so much.
Cowboy.